What's new, listeners? I'm Arthur Howell, the host of Two Cents Critic. If you're in the mood for reviews of books, movies, and TV shows, then join in. Today, we've got Kate and Renata, the host of the Worst Bestsellers podcast on the show. So we're going to come on to talk about The Life of Chloe Brown, the contemporary romance novel by Talia Hibbert. Say hi, guys.
Hello, thanks for having me. This is Renata speaking.
And I'm Kate, and happy to be here.
Yay, I want to thank you very much for being able to come on here. And now you're a book podcast, and typically you tend to veer more towards, you know, bad books, like, you know, Ready Player One, The President Is Missing, Go Wash Your Face. But you've covered some, like, you know, some good books as well, like A Ring of Endless Light. Like, I haven't read that, but, you know, you were generally, like, in favor of that book. So, you know, you break away from the
podcast all
the time.
Yeah, so during most of the year, we do try to read popular books of questionable quality, which sometimes do end up being better than we think they might be. And then over the summer, we like to give ourselves a little break and do something we call Flashback Summer and revisit childhood favorites, which A Ring of Endless Light was from that category. So pretty much over the summer, we are reading enjoyable children's books.
Yeah, and we do sometimes throughout the year, too. You know, every once in a while, we'll give ourselves a little treat and schedule a book that we know is going to be good, but we think might be zeitgeisty or is related to a topic that a guest wants to talk about or something like that. And then, like Renata said, sometimes we read these books and we think, oh, this will probably be bad. And then it turns out, oh, actually, this was good. And sometimes it's so good that we want to launch a whole other podcast where all we do is read that author's works, specifically Nora Roberts in this case.
Yeah. A whole ton of books on your podcast. And now today we're going to be covering a book that, at least I want to say right now, I think is a good book, in my opinion. Again, that's Get a Life, Chloe Brown. This is actually the first book in the Brown Sisters series by Talia Hibbert, and I've already read the whole series before, and I very much enjoyed it in the past, and now I'm excited for us to dive into this book now. So now let's just get right into it. You know, so what are your thoughts on the book, and Kate, let's start off with you.
All right, well, I'm gonna tell you a secret, which is that I told Renata this secret this morning. So I wrote down that we were going to be reading the second book in the Brown Sisters series, Danny Brown's book. So I read that like over the weekend and was like, oh, this book slaps. This is great. And then this morning, looking more closely at our email chain, I was like, oh, shit. I read the wrong book. But luckily, the audio and the regular book were on Hoopla, and I was able to I am a person who can listen to audiobooks very fast. So I at a very fast speed, and I was able to listen to Chloe Brown during the day today. And I liked it. You know, I actually would say I didn't like it as much as Danny's book, but it was very good. The characters were very good. I was very impressed with how she dealt with the various intersections of these characters' lives, their physical health, their mental health, their past relationships, and how all of those things aren't necessarily cured by the happily ever after, but that the happily ever after comes for these characters when they decide that they are going to work together to work on these aspects of themselves that are still works in progress, but that being together is important to them. It was delightful.
Good. And man, so wait, how long was the audiobook?
They're 10 hours. Both of them were 10 hours long. So I did it at two speed, which is 5 hours total. So that wasn't that
all
bad.
All right, yeah, crunch time. Got to, you know, squeeze the Chloe Brown book in.
Yeah, which honestly, normally I listen to books at like 1.5 or 1.75, so it wasn't that much of a stretch to go up further. I was afraid I was going to have to pop it up higher than that, but I managed to get the timing right that I even had time to eat dinner when I finished
it. You know, but sometimes I'll speed up the audiobooks as well, so, you know, I can subsidize there. And as for you, Renata, what is your take on Get a Life, Chloe Brown?
Yeah, I was really excited for the chance to read this book. It's one that I've had on my radar, the whole series, for, you know, a while. I've definitely heard good reviews of it from my friends who read more romance than me. And so I expected to like it, and I did like it for, you know, the reasons that Kate said. I was really impressed with the intersectionality of the characters and how it did really... you know, I like the dual POVs that we got. We could understand like where the disconnects were throughout, and like you never felt like either the characters was totally right or totally wrong. Like you were just like rooting for them to get on the same page, I would say.
All right.
My other main impression is when I read romance novels, I mostly read like closed door romances, and this is like open door romance. And I was like, this is spicy.
Yeah, it's definitely pretty spicy, definitely. Although I feel like I've read tons of contemporary romances, so I feel like maybe comparing this to other romances could come off as even steamier. Which may be surprising, but so for Get a Life, Chloe Brown, I gotta say I very much enjoyed this book as well. And you know, I think, you know, it's the first time around. I think I read this maybe like a couple years ago, I'd say, or maybe a year and a half ago. And I'd actually read, so the way I got into Talia Hibbert's work is that I read Danny Brown's book before Chloe Brown's book, because the way it goes in the series is Chloe, then Danny, then Eve's book, all three of the Brown sisters in that order. And I read Danny's book before that, and I very much enjoyed that book. Again, generally enjoyed all the books. But for Chloe's book specifically, you know, this was just a really fun to read. You know, a lighthearted romance, and I enjoyed how it flips around the tropes. Typically, you get like the grumpy sunshine, like, you know, typically the grumpy man and the sunshine woman. Here, it's kind of like, you know, flipped around, and we've got Red being the sunshine and Chloe being more of the grump. And the way they interact and, you know, the banter, and I especially appreciate like the snark of Chloe and the sweetness of Red. And the way that the representation is handled in this book for things like, you know, chronic illness and also like body size. And I especially appreciate how, like, mm-hmm. because Chloe is kind of like she's written as someone who is as someone who's curvy, and even on the cover you get to see that as well. And I appreciate how it's never an issue in the book. Like, there's never a point where she's feeling insecure about her body, which surprisingly enough, we don't even get it. It's not like we even get that kind of thing from other people in the book. It's all just, you know, accepted. It's just like, you know, it's just her body, and it's not a main point in the book. And I think I especially appreciated that after reading a couple of contemporary romances lately, where that has been an issue, and I kind of questioned the way it was handled in those books, and so it was just nice to go to this, and it's just all comfortable here. It's just all, you know, it's just, you know, again, body size. It's just a thing here. Like Chloe, you know, Chloe's hot. You know, there's no question. Like, oh, like, you know, about the body, and it was all just really nice to consume.
I appreciated that too in both Chloe and Danny's books. Like, I love good fat rep, and I love, especially when it's not, you know, I love reading like a really self-confident fat character who's just like, fuck you to their haters. But also it was great to read these books where the main characters like were fat intentionally. It was not commented on. And in fact, like, their love interests saw them as, you know, extremely hot and extremely gorgeous, and that didn't come into it. And that was great.
Yeah. And not only that, not even like, oh, I don't think you're fat. It was like, oh, she like Red uses lush to describe her body a lot. Like her thighs are lush. Her belly is lush. Like, and that's such a like hot way to think about a fat body, I think.
Yeah, and he's into all of it. Like he's fine to be so stunning, and that's great. And I'm not saying it's bad for books to have like a depiction of fat phobia and for fat characters to overcome that, as long as it's handled respectfully. But I just like to have a blend. You know, let's have all of the different options. You know, and this is just happens to be an option where again, fat phobia isn't a thing. It's just, hey, you know, Chloe's fat, and you know, that's just the way it is, and she's hot. And then also, and then going back to the chronic illness, because Chloe in the book has fibromyalgia, and I thought that was also, I think Claudia Hibbert did a great job here, because and in real life, the author also has a fibromyalgia, and so this is kind of like an own voices thing going on. And just and with that, and with Talia being a black author, and just you know, I feel like again, representation was, you know, was done pretty well on all accounts there.
Yeah, I would agree, and also you know the same thing with Red's anxiety and PTSD, you know, was handled very well. And was treated like very respectfully by the book. And he was, you know, treated respectfully about those things by Chloe, which was great.
Yeah. And so, I feel like that could have been a lot heavier. Like, I'm surprised because, again, I still feel like this book is pretty lighthearted. But even when that element comes in, we get tense about it. You know, kind of like I feel like for the first half or so, and then as the book goes on after that, especially towards the end, then we finally find out all of what's happened. And not that it isn't heavy, like the content matter itself, but the way it's handled doesn't feel like it's, you know, it's ultra depressing, you know. And I feel like sometimes I have read contemporary romances where it can get really heavy, and you do really have to put up the trigger warnings for this. Not that you don't have to for this as well, but still, like, you know. Oh, I feel like still this is a, again, lighthearted, I keep using that word to describe this book. And I feel like that's the way it is.
Yeah.
Yes. And so also, so I don't think you probably you've read any of Talia Hibbert's work before, right?
Nope, aside from the one that I read this weekend.
Yeah.
These were my first two in rapid succession.
Yeah, I've only read this one.
Yeah, and I do want to get into more of a work. It's like a different book that I've read of hers outside of the series, and I enjoyed that as well. It was like a, I think it was like a friends to lover sort of thing. And she actually started her writing career by funding it with an inheritance from her great-grandmother, and was self-publishing in 2017. That's when she started writing, and then producing like her first 9 books in just a single year. And Get a Life, Chloe Brown was actually her first traditionally published book when it came out back in 2019.
Wow, so it's also own voices for like quirky heiress.
Yes.
And apparently I was looking to buy her up, and she's only like 26 or 27 years old.
Wow.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's just like, man, you've accomplished so much already as a writer, and I'm jealous.
Yeah. Also, like, I did feel like, I recently have read a bunch of, or I'm in the process of reading a bunch of contemporary romances that were written by millennials, starring millennials, and there was a very, like, it had that same feel, like, reading these two books by her. I was like, oh yeah, like, I could know these people. I could be friends with them. Like, they're, like, weird and neurotic.
And lovable.
And, like, have the same sense of humor that I do.
Yes.
I could be friends with them in real life. And so I am a little surprised that she's that much younger than I am.
Yes. And also, well, just, you know, talking about representation also, she also, I think, does a great job with handling autistic leads in the few of her novels. And she's also autistic in real life as well. So again, just like all of the own voices stuff going on. Yeah, just really appreciate it. All right, so I guess so. We've given our general opinions on Get a Life, Chloe Brown. And now we can move on to giving our wind-up scores. And this is for each of us give us a score that ranges from 0 to 100. So, Kate, let's start off with you. What is your wind-up score?
Oh, God. I'm so bad at things like this. I think I would say probably, like, I would give this one, like, probably, like, an 85. I would go higher for Danny. But this one was very good, you know, like high 80s.
Good. And Renata?
Okay, first I do have a question, because I know your podcast gives a wind-up score, and I didn't know what that meant, and so I Googled wind-up score, and it comes up with, like, wind-up pitching, but it didn't really, like, is this a sports term, or is this a phrase that you coined yourself, or, like, what is a wind-up score exactly?
Oh, so I just coined it myself. That's my way of being like, hey, this is what I call giving a rating, you know, for whatever I review.
Okay, so I'm not winding up to throw the book.
No.
I just want to be clear. No. Okay. I will give it an... You know, honestly, I feel like 85 is the number I had in my heart, but I don't want to seem like I'm copying Kate. So I'm going to say 84 and a half.
All right, 84 and a half. And my wind-up score is going to be 87. And, yeah, just, again, very much enjoyed this book. And I'm now curious, because I've actually heard some people did enjoy, like, I think there's a lot of readers who, like, liked or enjoyed Get a Life, Chloe Brown. And then when they move on to the next book, and then apparently they're like, holy crap, this is amazing, I love this even more. Which is interesting. So, yeah, take a hint, Danny Brown. I feel like maybe there are people who are like, yeah, this is even better. And so, yeah, I'd be interested to, like, you know, get back into the other, maybe the other Brown Sisters books and see how I feel about them. But, yeah, for this one, for Get a Life, Chloe Brown, I'm going to go with 87. All right. So, yeah, so now we've given our wind-up scores, and now I'm going to just give a trigger warning for the listeners so they know that this book does deal with chronic illness, discussion of past domestic abuse, discussion of ableism, anxiety, a bit of classism and racism. And yeah, so I think those are all the triggers, or at least the ones that I caught on in the book. And now we can... And now we can move on to the spoilery breakdown of Get a Life, Chloe Brown. So listeners, if you have not read the book and you don't want spoilers, then you can just pause the episode right now and you can try to pick up the book. Or if you have read the book, or if you haven't, but you are okay with spoilers, you can stay right here. And all right, so now we can, again, spoilery breakdown. So I love how the book just opens up with this prologue and how it starts with, once upon a time, Chloe Brown died, nearly, as a white Range Rover almost ran over. And, I forgot to mention this earlier, this also takes place in Britain. And from what I found specifically, I think Nottinghamshire, specifically. I forgot to mention that earlier, because Talia Hibbert is British.
Yeah, I did having read... The Danny Brown, I know I'm going to keep referencing the fact that I read the Danny Brown book first, but it just, like, reading them in that order in rapid succession did color a lot of the way that I saw this book. So that, like, going from reading that to, like, hearing the first few sentences of this book, it definitely threw me for a loop until it started to dive down deeper into, like, okay, well, she didn't die. She just, like, almost got hit by a car, sort of. And not, you know, was not, it was charming. I think the narrator of this book is charming. And I think it was a good kind of way to propel the plot forward into her, like, thinking about it as a near-death experience and not, like, being a witness to something that happened and using that as her motivation to create the list that will propel the rest of the book forward. Her list of things that she wants to do now that she wants to stop wasting her life, her ways that she's going to get a life and go out there and reclaim all of the things that she gave up when she was settling into her diagnosis of fibromyalgia.
Yes, you get a life list. Yes, yes. And I also like when Gigi, her grandma, comments on, she's like, therapy is always necessary. I like her little comments.
I love Gigi, and I really would love to read a whole Gigi book.
She is delightful. Just, she got so much, you know, spunk. And we don't see her that often in the book. But she's there. She's like, you know, she's a more of a minor character. But she has a presence, definitely.
And she's there, and I would love to read her romance with her yoga instructor.
Yes.
You know what? I'd actually forgotten that bit pops up at the end of the book. And it was just all so, it was all just so amusing. I loved it.
Yeah, Gigi is great. The whole Brown family is great. Oh, like, yeah. Having, you know, so Chloe, during her fibromyalgia diagnosis, her quest for a diagnosis, she lost a lot of her friends. Mm-hmm. And her family stood by her. And Yeah, lost her. Her fiance dumped her too. And it is just, like, very nice to have this, like, yes, like, she's part of, like, this big family where everyone is just wacky and they love each other so much and they're so supportive of each other. And they're there for each other.
It's just all lovely.
Yes, with all of them with very distinct personalities and voices. It was great. I love the Brown family.
I know. Yes. And sometimes you read stories about characters have to deal with shitty families, and then other times you get to read about families like this, or, you know, you get to watch like families on Miss Marvel, another show that had like a lovely family that I just really got into. And
I did love Kamala's family on that.
Oh, it was fantastic. spoilers for anyone who hasn't watched Miss Marvel yet, but remember when Kamala, when she revealed her superhero identity, and her family is like, they pretend to be shocked at first, but then they're like, oh yeah, we knew already. And it was just so supported right away. Oh. Lovely.
Yeah, they're sweeties.
Yes. And then so Chloe, she also has had fainting spells, and so in the prologue she does faint for a bit. Since she ends up being dramatic and creating this whole eulogy for herself and imagining Piers Morgan reading it on the radio. Imagine if I died, I haven't, like you were saying, you know, Kate, you know, it's like, I haven't accomplished anything, and then this is what gives her the push to, you know, make up for, get a life list. And I also she also needs to move out of the house. That's the thing, because it's the whole family, like, still lives together, like the sisters still live in the family house, and then this is when she's like, no, I need to get out of here. And it's funny, I think it happens, if I recall correctly, it happens in the other book as well, with Danny and Eve also move out of the family house as well. If I recall correctly, I have not read the books in a while, but something like that.
Yeah, and she moves into a very middle class, in case it wasn't clear from the way we were describing her earlier, if you're listening, you haven't read the book. She's from a very wealthy family, and she moves into a very middle class apartment building, and immediately clashes with the...
They call him the superintendent.
Yeah.
Which, yeah. I mean, is that in the U.S. when a building has a super, is that what it stands for? I feel like it's something else.
Yes.
But I can't.
Yes.
It is superintendent?
No.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah. And
well, he's great. He takes such good care of that building. And, like, I live in an apartment with the world's most hands-off landlord. And I was just like, how did I, like, this wasn't even part of the romance, but whenever it'd be like Red, like, look down the hallway, notice a scuff on the door, he'd have to repaint the door. I was like, he's just doing that without them even asking? Like, my, I've been trying to get somebody to repaint this bathroom ceiling for months, and it rains paint flakes down on me every day when I shower. Like, Red would never let that happen to me.
Yes, so vigilance. And I forgot to comment on this earlier. So this is kind of like the minor element of classism here, because that's kind of like, it drives a wedge between Redford Morgan, or Red, again, that's the superintendent, and Chloe, because he thinks that she's being snobby and like, oh, she comes from this rich family, but she isn't really, she isn't snobby. I feel like she just isn't like that. She doesn't try to, you know, throw her money around. She's just pretty, I feel like, pretty humble about her, about the wealth she comes from. And I feel kind of conflicted, because I feel like maybe I feel like the classism thing is kind of like, oh, it's in the book kind of as it starts off, but then it's not really important later on. So I feel like maybe that's kind of like the one, a gripe that I have for the book, with the classism aspect. Is not wrapped up as neatly as I would have liked.
Yeah, like Red does catch Chloe in a couple awkward situations with other tenants, where after they have wronged her, he walks in on her getting angry at them or like retaliating, and it's just like, oh, she's just this like posh girl with a fancy accent from, you know, a fancy place who's come into our little building and is causing trouble. And it also, I think I felt that the reason for the class conflict there was mostly to put her in juxtaposition with his ex-girlfriend, mm-hmm. who was also upper class. And that, you know, that really felt to me like that was what the point of that aspect of Chloe's biography was for within the narrative, like what role that played.
Yes. Yeah, I can see, again, I see how it's supposed to kick things off in the beginning, but I feel like still later on towards the ending, I feel like, again, just wrap it up a little more, maybe like give a mention to that, to the classism aspect there. But instead, I feel like it's kind of just dropped off, you know, towards the end of the book. I don't know, like, Renata, do you have any thoughts on this? Or,
well, what do you mean by wrapping up the classism? Because, the issue,
I guess just, like, acknowledging that it happened. Because I feel like it wasn't acknowledged. I feel like, it was just kind of like, oh, it happened, it's happening, but then it just kind of drops off, and we never really return to the fact that there was classism going on in the beginning, you know? Again, just to wrap it up a little more neatly. I just like to have stuff wrapped up, you know.
Yeah. Well, I guess to me it was like when he like revealed kind of his full backstory with his ex Pippa. I think the issue really is that Chloe wasn't being classist in her behavior. She was being perceived as classist because of Red's baggage. So I don't think that Chloe really needed to acknowledge being classist, because she wasn't. She was just being like in her own head and being shy and being awkward, and he was perceiving it that way.
All right, yeah. I can see that.
The true nightmare for anyone who's bad at social interactions.
Oh, fully.
But yeah, definitely. Yeah, she herself was not being classist. Again, it's like, yeah, it was like the situations she was in, and so she's in the apartment, and then also I like when he's mending the elderly woman's toilet bowl. That's kind of like a funny thing for us to kick off with when we get into his POV. Yeah.
Yeah, I did actually laugh out loud at the part where it's revealed that the reason that he has to come and unclog her toilet bowl so often is that her grandsons are wrapping their dinner up in paper towels and flushing it down the toilet.
And he's guilted into trying out her vegetable casserole.
Yeah, he's a nice boy.
And then also, even Vic, so there's also Vic the Danzelwood. He's also a minor character here. And he's also kind of funny, too, when he pops into the book. And it's funny how, like, he misinterprets a text from Reg and thinks he wants to dial up steam with Mrs. Conrad. That's the woman that's put it forward.
Yeah.
And then, so yeah, so we do get a couple of brief mentions of Pippa, Reg's ex, but nothing more at this point.
And we find out here that on Chloe's list of, I think there's 7 or 8 things on it, I don't remember what they all are, but one of them is to do something bad. And in her mind, she's crossed that one off already, because even though she doesn't like Red, because he is, you know, really standoffish towards her whenever he sees her, she has aesthetically admired him when she realized that her window looked in on his art studio and she could spy on him painting topless at night, and she feels very bad about doing this, but justifies it to herself by saying, well, I did say I was going to do something bad, and this is the bad thing that I've chosen to do.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And then just...
And also, she doesn't think that he can see her, so she thinks it's, like, something harmless, sort of.
Which is a very poor understanding of how windows work.
Yes. Which Red does point out to her.
Yes.
Later, but... Yeah.
Because it's even one night when she is watching him, and then finally he turns away and she ducks down from the window and flicks the curtain closed, and she's like, oh, he didn't see me, right? And then we just cut to the next chapter where it's like, oh no, Red did see her. He saw her indeed. And now he has to deal with. And okay, so also, I was just looking at my notes here. So Danny did leave. Danny did move out of the house. Did move out of the Brown house by this point. And Eve is the final child there. Just wanted to clarify that, because I was looking at my notes here. Okay, and then also, I like how Red is close with his mom. And...
Yeah.
Yeah, just a little thing there. And he even has, like, the mom tattoo on his knuckles.
Yeah, that was pretty funny. And also very sweet that he is that close with his mom.
Again, that's his whole thing. It's like the sweetness, you know? It's got the caring, thoughtful personality.
Yeah, and then the thing that finally kind of brings them together, despite their avoiding each other, is that, and I did laugh when this happened in the book, Renata, and forgetting what podcast I was reading this for, I was like, Duarte, I love this part. Duarte being, for listeners of this show, Renata's cat, who is a co-host of our show. Mm-hmm. But when Chloe is walking down the street and sees a cat is stuck in a tree and isn't coming down, so she decides that she's going to climb the tree to rescue the cat, and then finds herself and the cat then stuck in the tree together, and Red comes by and has to help her down.
Yeah.
And yeah, it just really is hilarious. And she wants to keep the cat too. And she's like, this cat is mine, this cat is precious. And she does, and she ends up naming the cat Smudge.
Yes, but her building doesn't allow pets. So Red tells her she has like a month to find if the cat has other owners, to make sure it's not microchipped or anything, and give it back. And in the meantime, he won't tell anyone about the cat.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I also look kind of like, there's like the awkwardness, some more awkwardness between them, because she's like, she asks Red if he's taking drugs, which offends him, and she has to backtrack clumsily. And...
Yes.
And again, the fact of biology, it does play a role in the book, because she does, it comes up often. Like, she mentions, even when she's up in the tree, she's like, oh, you know, my joints are stiff, my back is aching. So that does make it difficult.
It's true. And then, like, Red catches on very quickly when he goes to visit her after, you know, she and the cat settle into the apartment. And you know, sees that contrary to her outside appearance, like the house is very cluttered and he sees a lot of like takeaway and convenience foods and a lot of like shipping boxes and a lot of prescription boxes. And as he kind of takes in his surroundings, he starts to realize like, oh, she has chronic pain. Like that's what this issue is here. Like that's what the larger problem is. And from the very beginning, he's very understanding of it and very kind to her and willing to care for her, even though at this point they still only barely acknowledge each other's existence and don't particularly like each other much.
I think he definitely falls into the sentimental romance trope.
Like, even before he goes to her apartment, like, when he's helping her down from the tree, he notices her wince in pain, and he's like, oh, did I hurt you, or did you get hurt when you fell? And she says no, and she wants to pretend like she's fine, but he notices that she is visibly in pain. And I think, like, that is such a good part of any, like, romance in particular, is, like, you know, you want to feel seen by the love interest. Like, you want them to, like, you know, look at you and know you and understand you. And even though they have these other, you know, miscommunications, he does that immediately. Like and as he learns more that like other people thought she was, you know, faking it or not really sick, he is extremely indignant because he's like, it's obvious that you're in pain. Like, even though you try to hide it, like you can tell that you are really in pain and it's not like a made up disease or whatever.
Yes. Again, just, yeah, I really appreciate it. Again, just how much he was paying attention to her, and when Red is up in her apartment, he learns she's in web design, so this leads up to Chloe whipping up a deal for him to give her a ride on his motorcycle in exchange for her doing a consultation on his website, because he has a website, because again, he paints, and so she's gonna help him make out the website for him to promote his artwork. And I like when he notices like her slippers, and there's a passage that goes, the slippers surprised him until he remembered that Chloe used cuteness to disguise her inner evil, sort of like Professor Umbridge. Except he couldn't imagine Professor Umbridge saving a cat from a tree. Never mind, you think about that later.
Although I do have to say Professor Umbridge was a known fan of kittens, so she might have.
Yes, yes. when Vic, the landlord, and his wife, they agree over the phone with Red that he's talked about Chloe too much.
Yeah, has already mentioned her enough that they're, not suspicious in a bad way, but curious, we'll say, about her.
Yes. And then we have a beat where Eve just bursts into Chloe's flat, belting out a dinner men's hour, defying gravity. Again, the Brown sisters, you know, they're so entertaining.
Yeah, they're all very charming. But she, after the motorcycle ride with Red, she decides that she is... She's at this point where she's like, I am physically attracted to this man, but I don't know that I like him still, but I don't not like him, and decides to strengthen their deal. And instead of just him doing the motorcycle ride in exchange for a consultation, she'll do his website for free if he'll help her with some of the other things on the list. Yeah. And they include things like go camping, go out and get really drunk and go dancing, travel the world with nothing besides hand luggage. And also on the list, notably, is have meaningless sex. But she makes it very clear that he is not to be involved with that part of it.
He doesn't even know about that part of the list because she, like, rewrites the list to show him, like, a clean version of it.
Yes.
Yep.
And so he doesn't even know meaningless sex is on the list.
And the thing is, even before the motorcycle ride, there's this whole bit where Red has a wet dream about her, and then he ends up trying to jerk off to the thought of her, and that whole thing does happen. What do you think about this?
I mean, it was horny.
It was horny.
Yes, and the thing is, because the C word is also dropped into narration. And when I first read the book, again, a couple years ago, I will say I was pretty surprised. However, I think the British do it a lot more casually. I think they hit.
Yeah, that's right.
And so that's why I would, like, even when I was reading this, I was not surprised, but still, like, it pops up. I kind of forgot how much it does pop up in this book.
Yeah.
I guess I am kind of used to it because it does pop up a lot in, like, other porny things that I read, and it's never really fazed me in that context. Being used in context as a definition of a body part rather than as, like, a mean name you're calling a woman. Yeah. It doesn't. I'm just like, yeah, that works. Yeah,
I can understand that. I can understand that. But, yeah, so, yeah, again, on Lenny, and he wasn't even able to finish because Chloe dropped by, and so she's still hard, and meanwhile she's like going around the apartment, and he's all uncomfortable while she's there.
Yeah, it's very funny. It was very sweet and horny, and yeah, and so they agree to do this different, you know, to expand this agreement. And she already, like, even at this point, they're both at this point kind of like, this is maybe a bad idea because I am physically attracted to this person, but I still claim I don't like them. But they go through with it anyway and decide to go out to a club. And well, first he asks more about her background, and he says, like, if I'm going to do all this for you, like, I want to know more about why this list exists. So she fills him in on the near-death experience and on some of her issues around her chronic illness. And then once they go out to this club, it turns out that she's really fucking miserable there. That she, when she wrote this on her list, she was idealizing these outings she had with her friends when she was younger. And it turns out that, like, now that she's old, she doesn't want to be in a loud place drinking expensive drinks that she knows are going to fuck her up tomorrow. And, like, you know, dancing with strangers, and that this isn't actually fun anymore, which, oh boy, yes, that does not sound like fun.
It actually reminded me of a different book, The Kiss Quotient, and in that book, it's funny, that has a similar scene where the woman is with the man in the nightclub, and she ends up being uncomfortable, and it's just specifically in that book, the MC there is on the spectrum. So that makes it, like, whole nightclub environment just even more, you know, overwhelming for her. And she ends up having to leave. Yeah. Now, this scene, it definitely does remind me of that. And there's even, like, and then even when they're flirtatiously sending each other the email and the banter they exchange in the email, it's also really adorable, too.
Yeah, their emails are very charming. The banter in this book is on point.
And then even when Chloe realizes that the bars and nightclubs that Red wants to take her out to are all close to her place, and she's like, oh, like, is he doing this to make it easier on my body?
Yeah. And he was, because he's a very thoughtful boy.
Yes.
And then so, again, and, you know, on, and also, again, they're getting closer, and there's also a point in the apartment when they're getting, again, pretty steamy for each other. And, like, he's even, like, noticing the beat of sweat, like, dripping down their throats. And then they end up, like, they're getting very close to, like, making out. It's, like, very close. And things are getting warmer.
Yeah.
But she tells him to stop. And he, like, stops immediately.
Yeah, but they leave this club. And she says, well, what do you do for fun? And he's like, boring shit. And she's like, no, like, I really want to know. And so he takes her to an art gallery.
Yep. And And I like, you know, I like them spending time together at the art gallery. And then even like when just even the way it's designed, like when they're going into the alleyway and there's all of the, and there's all of the art, you know, just lining this pathway. And what do you think about this whole art gallery scene?
I thought it was a good mechanism for introducing more backstory for both of the characters. And it was, you know, like, I know that conflict needs to happen in books in order for the story to move forward. But like when they bump into, so they at an art gallery, they bump into one of Chloe's aunts right after they've been fooling around in the alleyway, and Chloe panics. And when her aunt says, "Oh, well, who is this?" and she has no idea how to define their relationship because they haven't talked about it at all, and she's panicking, she says, "Oh, it's no one." And then like tries to clarify, like, "Oh, it's a friend. Like, he lives in the building that I live in." But like Red is already like really hurt and is like, it is flashing him back to how he felt with Pippa, who is his abusive ex-girlfriend. And he is just unhappy with the events.
And with the,
I mean, he's literally triggered by it.
It isn't a situation where it's like, oh, like he was dealing with, you know, a relationship and, you know, obviously wasn't happy or, you know, it had some complicated crap going on. It's like, no, this was an abusive relationship that he was in. So it is understandable when something like this happens. It just makes him panic and just brings him back to those terrible times. And so, you know, I can understand that, definitely. Also, I do want to note also, this happens, again, so after they've been fooling around, and that happened in public, like they're doing it by the monument, and
yeah,
just like, man, the boldness of that.
Yeah, they definitely have like a tangible physical relationship and a physical chemistry.
Yeah, it's just like, yeah, just full on, and yeah, and it is apparent. The chemistry is apparent right from the start. Whether, you know, they're obviously noticing each other, and again, like, even, you know, again, back in that apartment scene when Red is just noticing her, and she actually thinks that he's being disgusted by, like, she thinks like, oh, I'm all sweaty, he's probably staring at my sweat, and but then no, it's like he's all horny for her. And then afterwards, I do like how after the run-in with Aunt Mary, he calls the Dr. Maddox, whom his mom had recommended for therapy. And I do appreciate that, like, you know, we have a man who is represented as one therapy, which is, you know, it is important. In general, I always appreciate therapy representation in books.
For sure. Shout out to therapy.
Yes. And Red has been avoiding Chloe. We also have stuff going on in Smudge, because then we find out that the cat actually has known her and has a little chip. So Chloe has to, you know, sadly, you know, she has to return the cat to the owner, and we find out that this is Annie. And so now, what do you think about Annie here?
I mean, thought Annie was pretty charming. I like their friendship that developed.
Yeah, I liked her as a character, but I also, like, as a cat lady myself, I did feel kind of devastated on behalf of Chloe when she realized she would have to give this cat back, because I really did love the kind of, you know, sort of one-sided banter between Chloe and Smudge when they're in the apartment, and she tries to sort of, like, politely negotiate with Smudge, who is a cat and doesn't care, which is something I do every day of my life with Duarte. He simply will not be reasoned with. That's a problem. But then,
he's still not paying rent.
Can you believe it? Slow freeloader. But then, yeah, so Annie, I think I liked her as a quirky character, and then I liked when she revealed that actually she's cat-sitting for a relative who has, like, 9 cats, and Annie's not really that attached to the cats, and A, that explains why, you know, the cat had been gone for so long, because Annie had also been traveling, and then B, as soon as she said that, I was like, oh, she's definitely going to give Smudge the cat back. Like, this is not a situation where, like, this is my beloved only pet and, like, you stole him. This is like, oh, there's 8 other cats, so you can probably have this one by the end of the book. Yeah, and spoilers, I was right.
Yeah, numerous cats. There was, like, 9 or 10 cats or something like that. And she, and most, I think most of them, she kept outside. So yeah, definitely makes sense to come up with that prediction, and I love Danny a lot as well. Like, she's just the way, like, she's like a, she talks fast, and she's just you know, she's got a lot of energy, and I was like, oh yeah, this is someone who would love to befriend Chloe, and they would get along, and she gives a card that reads Annie Amand, Nickel Whisperer.
Yes. Ooh. Yeah, and I think, like, her greater importance, too, is that, you know, Chloe has revealed that all of her friends and her fiancé abandoned her, and so the only social life she has is her family, and then, you know, we see her with Red, but, you know, we as humans also know that it's probably not that healthy for, like, her only friend to be her love interest. And so it's nice to be like, oh, and she's, like, rebuilding, like, a social circle as well. Like, she can have another friend and 8 more cats to go visit. And
Yeah. And
I like that, too.
And she's opening up, you know, forming more companionship in her life. I should also note that the cat was originally named Purdy after Perdita from 101 Dalmatians. And Chloe, she finds out to be, like, you know, she ends up taking some, you know, some distaste to that. She's like, Purdy.
Yeah, because Perdita is a dog. Yes. Not a cat.
And then Red comes over to Chloe's apartment and claims she understands, like, you know, why she said what she said to Aunt Mary, but he's still mad at her. And then there's a scene where he scoops her up and brings her to the sofa, and he's like, do you want sex? And she's like, you know, I love it, but my bowel fiber, my algae is hurting and draining my energy. And, you know, don't act like Henry, her fiance, who thought his penis could just save her health problems. And thankfully, Red is a thoughtful partner who just wants to, you know, hang out with her tonight. And he ends up forgiving her, too.
Yeah, that was nice to see her, to see Red be like, yeah, like, I just want to sleep here. Like, I just want to take care of you. I don't expect anything else. And, you know, it's good. It's nice.
And I haven't made it clear yet. Her fiance sucks.
Yeah, big time. And another thing I thought was nice was, like, he makes her dinner and spends the night and takes care of her. And then in the morning, she makes him breakfast, and he is surprised, and he's like, you know, you don't have to do that. And she's like, well, you made me dinner, so I want to make you breakfast. And he's not used to people doing nice things for him. He's sort of used to the good gestures only flowing in one direction, which is, like, he's the caretaker, which, you know, again, like, talking about the grumpy sunshine thing being flipped, like, the caretaker thing is a little bit flipped, too, because that is sort of, like, a more traditionally feminine role. Mm-hmm. But, like, we see that Red's mom is diabetic and has some other issues, and so he has been, like, a caretaker for her, and he's good at it. He's a good boy.
Yes, yes. And then I also appreciate how he's like, you know, fibromyalgia can't, you know, de-sex Chloe. And there's a moment where he does think now, like, oh, because she has fibromyalgia, you know, she can't be sexy. But, you know, he turns around, he turns that viewpoint around. And I appreciate that. You know, again, it's kind of like, you know, you can have chronic illness and be hot. You know, it's kind of like, you know, representation for like, oh, you can be fat and hot. Well,
yeah. Well, and I think his thought process too, it's not even just like, oh, I wouldn't think someone with fibromyalgia could be hot. It's more like he feels guilty for still thinking she's sexy and like wanting to have sex with her even while she's in pain, even though he does sort of like override the lust to take care of her. Part of him, I think, feels guilty for even feeling the attraction when he knows that she is not physically in that mood right now.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of like that feeling kind of like lingering at the back of his head, which, you know, I feel like that would be, you know, ingrained into us, into people, thanks to the way, you know, society views anyone who is like, oh, like, you know, if you don't fit into this conventional box, then you don't, then you also lack sexiness, you know? And so, yeah, I appreciate that.
Yeah. And it's around here, too, where she decides to edit her list, which previously, as we had mentioned, had said like have meaningless sex, and instead she crosses that out and she makes a new point on the list, which is basically to like keep Red in her life. Whoops.
Yes, and yeah, she does that. And oh, also there's a minor thing I have to point out here. So her cardigans. Any shots in the cardigans? Because at the point where Red realizes that the buttons for her cardigans are fake because of her dexterity issues, obviously. And I don't know, I was just like, kind of interesting. Do you have any thoughts on the cardigan stuff?
As a librarian and cardigan enthusiast, I do have thoughts. And the thoughts are, I understand that this is an accommodation for her not being able to do buttons. However, the point of a cardigan is that you should be able, like, you should be able to have it open. And I feel like she could just wear button-free open front cardigans, but she just aesthetically likes the buttons, which is valid, but impractical as a garment, I think.
See, I came to a similar conclusion, but for different reasons, which is that I very frequently, like, I have some open front cardigans, but most of my button-up cardigans I do not wear open. I just also aesthetically like the buttons. So I just wear them like regular sweaters. Like, I don't ever button or unbutton them. I just pull them on over my head and pull them off over my head. And I was questioning why she needed to have a sweater with fake buttons when she could just buy a cardigan that would come buttoned and not unbutton it.
Interesting. I've never had like a cardigan, so, but still, like, I, you know, I was just like, I like the looks of the buttons as well, but I prefer to just, you know, keep it closed, you know, just, you know, you could pull it on over like that, you know.
Yeah, that's, I mean, not to get too deep into my fashion theory, but I tend to use cardigans. I tend to have V-neck cardigans that I use as a color block on top of patterned outfits. So it's really just like, I can't think of the last time I wore a cardigan with the buttons open. You just pull it on and pull it off. It's fine. I was very stuck on that while reading the book, actually, because she mentions it early on where she says, like, you know, she like ran her hands down the buttons on her sweater. Like, she liked cardigans, but she couldn't use buttons. So this was her, you know, compromise. And I was like, girl, just get a cardigan and don't unbutton it.
Yes. And then, yeah, so yeah, she adds Keep Red to the list. And then when she called up Annie and was agreeing to meet with her in a, quote, busy, over-loud, and likely unhygienic coffee shop and harebell, which can only be described as the hipster quarter of the city.
Yeah, so actually maybe Chloe is a little bit snobby, but that's okay.
that was like, oh yeah, maybe a bit of snobbiness popping up there. And when Annie arrives, she has like a Marmite disaster, and she reveals like, and you know, like we were saying before, this is like when she talks about the cat stuff, and even when I was just looking at my notes, the way this opens up, she reveals that she doesn't like cat all that much, but then she made a deal with the goddess of the underworld, and for a second, Chloe is just like, oh crap, what is she going on about now? But then she revealed what the so-called goddess is actually her mom. So that's a moment. And we're able to bond, and you reveal what she's a lingerie designer. And that's why she's got, like, the nickel whisper. That's what it means on the card. And Chloe's like, hey, can you advise me on a shopping trip today? And then Chloe goes over to Red's place, and they're going to go camping. And this whole camping trip, you know, I appreciated them, you know, just kind of like being able to bond some more. This is also a moment when a couple yummy mummies, as Chloe called them, they scolded her for playfully holding the black ships at Rez. Oh, and then I forgot to mention this earlier, meowing. Did you notice how that was spelled? It was M-I-A-O-W. It was just an interesting
category. I think that's the British spelling.
Okay, I was like, yeah, I think it's it's a British spelling variation. It's just interesting.
I was listening to it, so.
Uh-huh. Yeah, my eyes.
That's just how British cats sound.
My eyes are just always used to the M-E-O-W. So it's just like, oh yeah, visually switch things up here.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought the camping trip was really sweet, the way that Chloe noticed that Red had, like, chosen a spot that wasn't too far from the parking lot, and that he set up the bed to be as comfortable as possible, and he put in the twinkle lights, and it was very sweet, but also sexy.
Yep.
Yes, I concur on both points.
Yes. Yeah, and they have the s'mores, and then playing 21 questions, and so playing 21 questions for a bit, which does quickly lead into her asking him about what happened in London. And so this is when we get the whole backstory about him and Pippa and how he was attempting to break into the art world, make a name for himself, and then he met Pippa, whose dad is an art dealer, and he was able to help Red make connections. But at the same time, Pippa was abusive, both physically and emotionally. And I got really mad when I was reading about her trying to prevent him from seeing his mom. And his mom just hated her.
Yeah.
You know, understandably. Yeah. And then when he tried to see his mom again, this built up to Pippa stabbing his hand with a fork. And there were even, like, tiny scars left beneath his knuckles.
Yeah, it was bad.
Yeah, the whole thing, and even when he realizes, like, oh, I need to get out of this relationship, when it ends, when he breaks up with her, she tears him down, and she told him, like, he's nothing without her, people only care about him because of her connections her dad formed for him, and it was just awful, I said this before, like, what's happening, if you're in an abusive relationship, it's definitely, it's heavy, but somehow I feel like Talia Hibbert is able to balance it just enough with the story so that it doesn't feel overwhelming, you know, it doesn't feel, again, like, disgusting to read about.
I think it helps that, like, for Red, some time has passed, and he's, like, sort of begun to heal a little bit on his own, even though you can tell that he is... you know, literally and mentally scarred from it, and it contextualizes why he is so defensive earlier when he thinks Chloe is being snobby. But then also, like, we know that Red is getting therapy, so, like, it isn't as fresh as it used to be, and he is sort of, like, doing some work to get over it, so I think that allows it to be a little bit less dire in the narrative.
And I think and there are plenty of relationships like this where it is what between women and men, where it's a woman who is the abuser, and then the man will end up getting just brushed off his pain because he has been taken off because, like, oh, he's a man, and of course, like, a woman can't be the abuser in this situation, but it's like, no, it's not true. Obviously, just kind of thing, like, between Red and Pippa, it can happen. It does happen. And so, I just felt like the representation for this was good to see here. Something I haven't really seen often.
Yeah.
And that's why Red just gave up on all of the art crap and cut himself off from everyone. He knew in London, including like the Fiona, they met back at the art gallery, and he was doing all of this as like a, you know, kind of like a form of self-protection after Pippa's vicious breakdown of his character. And he thought about getting back at it, but he ended up being paralyzed just for over a year. And I love how, like, you know, he was shaming himself for his behavior, but Chloe assured him that if Pippa, who's the villain here, Red, was just doing, you know, again, to self-protection, and it wasn't wrong, it was just like, yeah, this is what happened. And now you can try to rebuild your career.
Yeah, and not only does she, you know, reassure him and take his side, but even before she knew the full story, like, she genuinely loved his art and appreciated his art and, like, was sincerely moved by his art in a way that made him feel seen. You know, this is a book where the characters are seeing each other and making each other feel seen. And for Red, his art is a big part of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And she asks if he's seeing anybody, and he says he's just started going to therapy. Again, therapy is important. And there's also a point where she says to him, "You always say such lovely things to me, Red. Do you say them to yourself?"
Yeah, that part was very sweet. And he kind of freezes because he's not expecting that. And she goes on to say, like, lovely things about him.
Yes. And I think that's also self-love. I think that's also an important aspect of the book as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very, that... you know, go on.
Go ahead.
No, I said go on first.
Fine.
Okay.
Well, you know what? Actually, this is actually a good segue to what I was going to say, which was there's a part sort of early on, I think, where Red says that, like, friends fill in each other's gaps. And, like, you know, if there's something that Chloe can't do and it's easy for Red to do it, then he'll just, you know, do it. And she's kind of like, well, you know, it's not your responsibility to take care of me. And he says, you know, that he can and he will, like, fill in her gaps. And I think that's also, like, a big theme of this book is them, like, filling in each other's gaps and taking care of each other, you know, physically and emotionally when it's things that the other can't do. And so, yeah, for Chloe, I think reassuring him and building him back up in that way is her kind of way of filling in the gaps, which I thought was a very lovely way to think about relationships and friendships, and I liked it.
Yes, me too.
Now you're gonna make me emotional saying that us play fighting over saying something out loud is the segue into
Kate. We fill in each other's gaps in our lives, and also I filled in the gap of silence that was left for a half second in the podcast by talking.
It's true. I fill in your driving around Boston gaps. You fill in my loss of executive function gaps. It's fine.
You know, this is grabbing my eyes too.
Friendship is magic.
It is. I mean, similarly, I was going to say that, yeah, like, there's a lot of, yeah, like, a lot of the themes of this book, I think, are around that, like, you don't have to do everything yourself, and you don't have to be perfect to pursue a relationship as long as you're willing to work at it and work with the other person. Because that's kind of Chloe's thing, is that, like, she doesn't want a relationship until she gets her shit together. And, you know, this is kind of this revelation for her that, like, she, as long as she is making progress towards getting her shit together and is, you know, trying to change for the better, she can have someone there with her who is helping her achieve that along the way.
Yeah,
which is nice.
That's in a suitable way to word things, Kate. Yes, yes. And the last thing we have for the camping trip is when they get it on in the tent. And, you know, again, not the theme. I appreciate how the sex in this book does not feel superfluous. It's just like, whenever it happens, it's just like, oh yeah, this is a good place to put it. I feel like it's helping them connect a little more. It progresses the relationship, you know, a little more. Not that I'm averse to contemporary romances that have, you know, like tons of theme all over the pages. I feel like this is not as steamy as other books, but still, you know, fairly steamy. And I feel like the way just was utilizing the steam was it was appropriate for the relationship.
Yeah.
And even like also the fairy lights. I love the decoration of the fairy lights inside the tent.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they return home, and he visualizes himself marrying her sometime in the future. And then there's a knock on the door, and it turns out it's Danny and Eve, and it's all awkward because Chloe and, you know, Red is still in Chloe's apartment. So Chloe goes out there.
In bed.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, he's in bed with no clothes because his clothes are in the washer, so he's just sort of, like, hanging out under the sheets, kind of trapped.
Yes. And there's a moment where Chloe is like, do you want to come out and make your presence known? And Red realizes this is her way of compensating for making him feel like a nobody in front of Aunt Mary. But he's just like, now I'm just staying here, so Chloe goes out there. And this is when he overhears the conversation that Chloe has with her sisters about meaningless sex and camping, like, being on her list. And then Red hearing her saying that she put him on the list, and he's suspicious. He's like, wait, like, I didn't see those items on the list. And now he's panicking because he's like, wait, what's this all just fun for her? Like, has she been using me this whole time? Is she gonna discard me? Is she gonna be like Pippa? And then she's like, oh crap, like, you know, there's a point where the passage goes, like, no way she see him as an item to cross off a list. Or a specimen to study through a window. Fuck. And that's when he's just, like, again, spiraling into this alarm that he's feeling. And I won't say, the first time that I read this book, a part of me struggled with this third-act conflict, and I thought it was, like, I can understand where he's coming from, but there's a part of me that feels maybe it's kind of contrived. However, I think this time around, I'm much more sympathetic towards his position, and because, again, like, this is after his relationship with Pippa, and so he is, mm-hmm. you know, this is an impulsive decision he's making when he ends up wanting to break things off with Chloe, and he's just reacting out, you know, again, it's reckless behavior, but it's just like, yeah, I can understand mm-hmm. where the reckless behavior is coming from now.
Yeah, like, it yeah. is contrived and abrupt, but it is also, like, it has been very carefully set up that we've seen the repercussions of this abusive relationship, and this is sort of the thing that would hurt him the most. Mm-hmm. And then I still was kind of like, oh no. But then I also really like that he calmed down very quickly. Like,
yeah,
it took him about 10 minutes alone in his apartment to be like, oh, I overreacted and I really should go back and, like, hear what her side of the story was.
Not even in his apartment. Like, I think he stayed out in the hallway because after.
Oh yeah.
It was after, because he had to, like, Chloe was just unsettled by his whole change in behavior. And he was just, like, packing up to get that thing out of there. And she says, like, she's like, oh no, it's not bad to be on my list. And she's saying he's there because he's important. And he was also, he was being impulsive, so I can understand where he's coming from. But he was also saying some hurtful things to her. And he was accusing her of being, like, manipulative and lying. And it's just so painful because it's like, oh, like, it's so painful to read this, and
yeah.
But again, I've read kind of third act conflict before in contemporary romances, and it is essentially founded on a misunderstanding, and other conflicts it can come off as, like, oh, like, you know, this is, again, contrived, not believable. Why do we need this to amp up the drama? But in specific cases like this, where, again, because of what he had to endure from Pippa, I can understand why he's going down this path. And again, and then he cooled down afterwards. And
yeah, and he does, like, immediately I mean, not immediately, but it's just a few minutes that he realizes that he fucked up, but then also realizes that it's not going to be as easy as, like, walking right back in her apartment saying, like, oh, hey, my bad, I overreacted, so let's get back in bed.
Now she's like, she's on the other side of the door, and she's down in the hallway, and she's like, I don't think, like, I understand where you're coming from, but I still don't think we should see each other anymore. And even, like, for her, she panics because he's leaving her. She feels like he's leaving her, like her former friend and fiancé. And so now you've got all of the crap going on with her now. And kind of, like, her own kind of, like, relationship of PTSD.
Yeah. And, you know, so he's reaching out. He sends her a letter and chocolate and gifts. And she doesn't know how to react to any of it, because at first she thinks maybe the letter is a goodbye, especially because she sees on the notice board for their building that he's leaving his job as the super, and is like, he's doing this to get away from me. But then the gifts keep coming, and then she's like, okay, well, now I'm confused. And
the gifts are, like, so sweetly specific. Yes. Like, again, like, it's her specific favorite kind of chocolate. And then, like, it's a jar of hair ties because she can never find her hair ties. And at first she's like, yeah, but I can't even open jars because my hands are too stiff. And then she realizes it has, like, a special, like, I didn't really understand what lid she was describing, but it has, no, like, a special lid.
I couldn't completely understand either. I was just reading it. It's like a bubble cover. And I don't know if I've ever seen this before, but it's like a bubble cover where she pokes her hand into it, and then it gives away, like, it gives way beneath her hand. I'm assuming it probably, like, maybe folds away into the jar or something like that. I don't know if I've seen this bubble cover before, but obviously, like, I'm assuming it exists, obviously, so I can picture the way it works in my head, but again, don't think I've ever seen it before. But yeah, really.
But the point is, it, like, is very thoughtful.
And even the box, like, the first package she gets from him is Mark Button, because that's the nickname he comes up with for her. Button, the cardigans. And then even going back, I wanted to note that even going back to the hallway scene, she's like, when he's trying to, you know, get back together with her and apologize for his behavior, she's like, you don't need to be better, Red. Not for me. Never. And I feel like, self-love again, and then he waits a bit, and then he finally says, I love you, and he doesn't think Chloe's on the other side of the door anymore by that point, because he's been waiting, so he just whispered it, and then it turns out Chloe was still there, and she had heard him say that, and that's even, like, another little moment, because then it's like, oh, like, he was saying that for himself, it seems like, it wasn't for her. And adorable moments like that, heartbreaking.
Yeah, it was very good.
And yeah, so yeah, she's getting gifts. She also wrapped up the designing process for Red's website. And then also the first package included a notebook. And she feels like she has to, and she knows that he's written something in his notebook, like a letter to her, but she doesn't wants to read it because she feels like this is gonna be a goodbye letter, and then this will be, and then this will be like, oh, this is the end of our relationship. It's been terminated now. Again, because she thinks it's a goodbye letter, just keep sending her the cat gift packages. There's one with a cat plushie that reminds her. Smudge/Purdy. And now she thinks he might, and as she keeps getting these gift packages, she's like, oh, he might not be saying goodbye, but instead maybe he's written an explanation for his actions in his notebook. But before opening it, she drops by Gigi's attic yoga studio, and that's when we get a bit of Shivani, the yoga instructor there. I love how Chloe, there's a passage where Chloe, like, she does acknowledge that they're probably, you know, they're probably getting it on, you know, they're in a relationship probably, but Chloe also did not want to think about that, you know? I don't want to think about that for too much. For more than 5 seconds at a time, specifically in the passage.
Yeah. But yeah, she, like, Gigi thinks she's there to ask, like, how do I know if love is real? if, you know, if this love I feel is real. And Gigi says, like, that's not, or no, that's what Gigi thinks she's going to ask. And Chloe is like, no, I know it's real. I want to know if it's worth it. And how do you protect yourself from being hurt? And Gigi says, like, those are two very different questions. And the answer is like, yes, that it's worth it, even if you do get hurt. And this, I mean, it's both sort of like a little bit of a cliche, but it's also like every time you're like, oh yeah, that is a true point that, like, you know, you do kind of have to risk being vulnerable in order to experience real love. We've heard that before. We'll hear it again, but it's still true.
The mortifying idea, mortifying ordeal of being known.
Yes.
Yeah, and yeah, and then also, yeah, and again, self love, and when Gigi's like, yeah, you're a woman. I love that when she says, you know, you're a woman who, in a life filled with pain, came here to ask about love. Yeah, you know, really appreciate when Gigi says that.
Yeah.
And also, when all of the, you know, the love advice is happening. It's also funny when the moment with Gigi where she's like, oh, there's a passage that goes, Gigi puts glossy lips. When did they become glossy? Has she just applied makeup by psychic command?
And, yes.
When she brings out a cigarette, and Gigi and Chloe doesn't have any idea like where she got this from, and the passage goes, her knickers up one nostril. In an alternate dimension, she accessed it well. God only knew.
Yeah.
I love Gigi so much. And then even when Giovanni, she's going downstairs, and there's a passage that goes, she wasn't leaving the house, of course. No, she was just going downstairs to give Chloe and Gigi some privacy. And also to start Gigi's wheatgrass, chocolate, and Bailey smoothie, the perfect three dinner tipple, apparently. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so
yeah, GG fucks.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
And so yeah, it's all going on. And then so then we go back to Red, and then Red handed in his notice the day before. We find out when Chloe returns home and she reads notebook, she finds out from his letter that he handed in his notice the day before they went camping. Because dating her and being a superintendent would present a conflict of interest. And so that's why he's moving out. And he says he loves her, and he gives her this whole get Chloe back list.
Which is very cute.
Does
include a line about stealing Smudge back. which, spoiler alert, he doesn't even have to do, which we find out in the epilogue. But yeah, it's a very sweet list. And they decide to give it another try.
Because the way it happens is that she opens the curtains and looks straight across at Red in his apartment as he's painting. And he sees her, like, right after she opens the curtains. And then for the next chapter, we also switch over to Red's POV as he's been waiting through the week for Chloe to respond to him. Because this whole has been stretching out over time. Stretching out over the week. And then once he sees her looking at him through the window, and she knocks on his door, brings her notebook with her get a life list, and then he, you know, they make out a bit. He says, "I love you," and you know they're gonna get back together, and they, even though they pinky swear as well,
yeah, which is cute. Yeah.
And she says she loves him back, and then we have the epilogue 1 year later. Where Chloe and Red are in New York, and they've been stuck in a video call with the Brown family. And we also learned that Annie gave Smudge back to Chloe after she and Red moved into
an
apartment building. Yes, thank God. After they moved into a building that is now with pets, and Chloe and Red are going to visit MoMA. And also, a sweet moment when he checks up on her buprenorphine as well. That's come up earlier when she has, like, the buprenorphine patches. And
he's still, like, checking and making sure she's physically comfortable and, like, has clearly planned the trip with her ability and comfort in mind. And I don't think we mentioned earlier that one of the things on Chloe's list was she specifically wanted to go to New York.
Yes.
And Red also wanted to go to New York to see the MoMA, because he did go to New York with Pippa, but the one thing he wanted to do there was go see MoMA, but Pippa kept him busy and like they didn't get to go to MoMA. So now he does get to.
Now it happened finally. That's the story. That's Chloe and Red's romance. It's the end.
It's very sweet.
I know it really is, and I have a list of contemporary romances, but I always, you know, refer back to when I'm thinking of things I want to recommend to people, and typically, like, the whole Brown Sisters series has always been on that list. I think for contemporary romances, I'll say, like, hey, people, you know, we should check this out. And there's a good reason for that.
Yeah, it was good. I'm glad. I don't know. We'll see if I get around to reading Eve's, but I'm glad I read this one. I'm glad I read Danny's. Like, is very sweet. It was very warm and fuzzy and very horny and strong recommend.
Definitely. And also for Eve's book, that's also great, because as I said, you know, I think, I don't know if I've mentioned this before, but in Eve's book, both of the leads and dad are on the spectrum, and just the way it's represented, I really appreciate it, because again, Talia Hibbert herself is autistic, and just again, more of her own voices, you know, representation. I think it's particularly for books that feature autistic leads and are written by autistic authors. And do you have any more thoughts to express on the life of Chloe Brown?
I mean, mostly just that I liked it. It was good. I'm glad that I've spent my last 2 days reading these two books.
Yeah, I'd like to read the other two when I get a chance, for sure.
Yes. I guess there's a couple more things I'll comment on. Is earlier on, right before they enter the art gallery, when Red said, "You calling me cute, Chloe?" And Chloe says, "I am. You giant blushing art nerds." And then also we have, and also in the art gallery, right in the entrance, there was a pink garden chair that had a sign tied to it, with like some red silk, and the sign read, "Don't sit on me. I'm famous." Just had to comment on that. And all right, so that's Get a Life, Chloe Brown. And now we can move on to Good Words. And this is where each of us gets to recommend something, whether it's a book, a movie, a TV show, a podcast, music, anything we want. So, Kate, let's kick off with your Good Words.
So thinking about, well, this is double-edged. Part of it is that another piece of media that I have been consuming frequently over the past pandemic that I think does a really interesting job discussing chronic illness and chronic pain is, oddly enough, the cartoon The Owl House, which is just, I really love that show. I think more people should watch it. And it really, like, seeing how the main character, Ida, handles her chronic condition throughout the show is what I've heard from folks who do suffer from chronic pain to be, like, incredible representation of kind of what it's like and what it does to your relationships and the people around you. But also it's just a fun, creepy, weird show with a really great found family. And it's also very emotional at times, and it's good. People should watch it. It's on Disney Plus.
That's been on my TV watch list, and I've heard great things about it. I'm always into paranormal stuff. Like, even with Gravity Falls, which is a Disney show that I just finished, that also has tons of supernatural stuff going on. I love that. But for the Owl House specifically, yeah, definitely, again, on my TV watch list. And it is too bad that apparently I've heard it has good queer rep. But then it's like, oh, Disney just canceled it. And, you know, like, right as the queer rap is, you know, getting good, or at least, you know, something like that. I think that's what I've heard.
Yeah, it does have great queer rep. There's a ton of queer characters in it, a ton of queer background characters. It was canceled after the upcoming third season, but I think there were rumors going online that it was canceled because of the queer rep, when really it was pandemic-related budget cuts.
Oh. Damn pandemic. You know, and speaking of which, also I'm worried about the monkeypox now that has been declared in a public health emergency. And I'm just like, oh, did we not learn our lessons from the damn COVID-19?
Absolutely. We as a nation learned nothing.
Yes, never.
Hi, fellas. Yeah, so, Kate, your good word is the Owl House. Now, Renata, what is your good word?
I'm going to give it to the Remixed Classic series from Macmillan Publishers, which is a new-ish YA series where, as the title Remixed Classic suggests, like, they take these classic works of literature like Little Women and The Great Gatsby, and then a contemporary YA author remixes it in some way, which has included, like, for example, The Little Women one by Bethany Morrow, who's a Black writer. She's made The Marches a Black Family in Reconstruction Civil War, or I mean, you know, post-Civil War Reconstruction. And thinking of chronic illness, like instead of Beth just sort of being generally sickly, here Beth has sickle cell anemia, and they talk a little bit about like the history of that disease in a way that I thought was like really interesting. And just the way that these changes like ripple out, and even though it's the same basic story, it becomes like totally fresh and new and great. So that one I loved. And then I recently read Self-Made Boys, which is Anna Maria McLemore's Great Gatsby remix. And they have made Jay and Nick both trans boys. And Nick has also become a Latino trans boy. And just the way that this like changes the story and makes it so compelling. And yet like it mirrors the like beautiful writing of Fitzgerald, but it's just like totally new. And so I like those so much. I'm like, now I want to read all of them. And so I just started. I'm only a few chapters into What Souls Are Made Of by Tasha Suri, which is a Wuthering Heights remix. But it makes the characters British Indian instead of just like white British people. And so far, so good.
All right. That sounds nice.
Like, I feel like it's the kind of concept that could be like boring or just like, oh, this would be good assigned reading. But they, so far, they truly are like so fresh and so beautiful. It like really is making these stories new and good in a way that, that I love.
Good, good. And, you know, I always, you know, I like that when you can take old stories and, you know, because I feel like there's so many, obviously, like, you know, so plenty of stories around that feature, you know, white cishet characters. And it's just like, you know, you don't need all, you don't necessarily, you know, you don't need all of that. It's just, you can put new twists on the stories and in order to present more representation. So, you know, I'm always really for.
Because here's the thing, like, in the past, there were people of color there. There were queer people there. Like, I thought the great Gatsby remix was so interesting because there's an author's note about all the ways that trans men in the 20s used, like, the instead of binders, they had these kind of, like a, sort of like a corset. Like, but anyway, like, trans people existed in the 1920s, and they lived their lives, and you know, why not have a great novel about them?
Yeah, I know, and I always think about that, like, even for like the Wild West, because you always watch like Western cinema, and it's always focusing on white men, but then it's like, no, it's like there are plenty of black cowboys too, or there are also plenty of queer members of, you know, just like, of like, you know, ranch hands who are, you know, going around the place. But of course, like a lot of the stories we have don't focus on them, and specifically trans and non-binary ranch hands, plenty of them in the wild west. But again, don't, you know, we don't focus on them because we just love the white cishet men.
Yep.
So okay, that's a fine, good word, yes, yes. And now for my good word, it is going to be a House of Cinema. Now, this is kind of like a twofold good word, because House of Cinema is a podcast, specifically a movie podcast, and I think that, you know, if you're looking for something that's, you know, accessible, and but also it also does take like deep dives into the content that it covers, you know, I think this is a good choice to look for. And like, for example, there was recently the podcast came out with kind of like a two-parter focusing on Studio Ghibli, kind of like it was a Studio Ghibli Hall of Fame Part 1 and Part 2, just covering the whole filmography. And it's also great to listen to that, because I personally have actually never seen any Studio Ghibli movies through all my watch list, but I just really want to get around to them. And I want HBO Max, but I don't have HBO Max, unfortunately. So again, I want to see all of them, but these episodes particularly were great to listen to from House of Cinema, because they were non-spoilery. So it's just like, you know, Joe Aragon, he's the host, he also had a guest on, and it's like they get to talk about Studio Ghibli, but just like ranking the movies without getting into spoilers. So yeah, just really accessible there, and plenty of other episodes as well for House of Cinema. And then on top of the podcast, I'm also recommending the Discord server for the podcast as well. And I'm actually joined this Discord server recently, and it's a fun community there, you know, just talking about movies, TV shows, stuff like that. And I would highly recommend, you know, if anyone is interested, like, you know, if you're on Discord, you know, come check out the House of Cinema Discord server. And I can also include an invite link in the show notes for this episode. So you can just click on the link and check out the House of Cinema Discord server there. So yeah, so that's my good word. Both the podcast and the Discord server, House of Cinema.
Excellent.
Yeah, so now you've given our good words, Kate, Renata. Again, I want to thank you both very, very much for being able to make time to come on my show. Really appreciate it. I've been listening to your show for a while, especially like listening to your show, also listening to I Don't Even Own a Television, which also, you know, you're fans of them. I've also had them on my show. And so I've been looking to make the connections for a while, and now it's finally happened. Yes.
Yeah, well, when you give bad book podcast hosts the chance to read a good book, we'll take it.
Yeah, like, thanks for having us. This was fun. And yeah, it was exactly what I was going to say, Renata. So nice to have to read a good book.
Yep. And now this is the time when you can promote your podcast, promote your socials and such.
Yeah. Well, podcast. Sorry.
I was just going into our usual pattern, which I say first.
I was too, but then there was like a pause. So let's do that. You go. Let's do usual.
Our podcast is called Worst Bestsellers. Our website is worstbestsellers.com, and you can follow us on social media. We're on Facebook and Instagram, we're Worst Bestsellers spelled normally, and on Twitter, we're at Worst Bestseller with no S, because Smudge knocked that S off the counter, and we don't have it anymore.
Yes, you can find us wherever podcasts are podcasted from. You know where, you're listening to a podcast right now. We also have a Patreon at patreon.com/worstbestsellers with some good perks. And then we, too, have a Discord server that you can get to most easily by going to worstbestsellers.com and clicking on the Discord link there. Mm-hmm. And I personally, on social media, I'm at 14 across. I don't post on Twitter much anymore, but I'm fairly active on Instagram and Tumblr.
Mm-hmm. And I'm at Renata Snacks.
All right. As for my socials, you can find this podcast on Twitter and Instagram at 2_sensecritic. You can follow my personal Twitter account at @_ant18. That's also the same handle I use for GoodPods, StoryGraph, and Letterboxd. You can find me on Goodreads at Audra Howell. If you want to email me, you can do that at email2sensecritic@yahoo.com. You can also check out my blog at 2centscritic.com. Make sure you subscribe, rate, and review this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, whether it's Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Anchor, Google Podcasts, Good Pods, etc. And make sure you focus on the ratings and the views there, because it really does help to bump up the numbers, spread podcasts to more listeners. Again, hey Granada, I enjoyed our time very much today.
Thanks for having us.
Welcome.
Yeah,
this is great.
And until next time, stay healthy and stay strong.